Chapter 1.
The first chapter takes you to one of the central institutions of Brave New World, the Central London Hatchery and Conditioning Centre. This is a factory where human babies are mass-produced. The director of the centre and Henry Foster are showing around a group of students who get an overview about the different steps of producing people. The first room the students see is the fertilising room, in which female ovaries are artificially fertilised in test tubes. In these ovaries, persons belonging to the 5 different castes are produced.
I remember. The 5 castes are the alphas, betas, deltas, gammas, and the epsilons.
Exactly. Alpha and beta ovaries are left in their test tube to develop into one embryo, whereas gammas, deltas, and epsilons undergo the so-called Bokanovsky process. This is a process which can be compared to our cloning, and the director is really proud of it. He boasts,
"One egg, one embryo, one adult. Normality. But a Bokanovskified egg will bud, will proliferate, will divide. From 8 to 96 buds, and every bud will grow into a perfectly formed embryo, and every embryo into a full-sized adult, making 96 human beings grow where only one grew before. Progress."
In the bottling room, all ovaries are transferred into glass containers and labelled according to heredity, date of fertilisation, and membership of Bokanovsky group. Sent along on a conveyor belt, the ovaries then arrive in the predestination room, where their destiny of belonging to one of the social castes is fixed.
I think embryos are treated and conditioned according to their later function in society.
Yes. Additionally, 3 different sexes are created by giving different hormones: male, female, and free Martins. That means sterile females. All this ensures that in the last room, the decanting room, a person which perfectly fits the need of society will be decanted. That means born out of a bottle.
But is there no action in this first chapter of the novel?
Well, in the centre, there is a description of the mass production of human beings who are perfectly fit for a perfect future society. Huxley uses the guided tour to introduce the reader to his fictional world. He can give us all the important information without making it boring, because the students' reactions are sometimes weird or funny. For example, they're embarrassed by the words mother or father, which they consider to be obscene.
Which I thought was really funny.
So did I.
Chapter 2.
In Chapter 2, the tour through the centre continues. First, the director shows the students how babies are conditioned in order to fulfil the needs of society. They are conditioned to dislike roses and books. When they play with these things, explosions, sirens, and alarm bells go off. To make it worse, they receive electric shocks. Consequently, their first liking of these things turns into horror.
Horrible! What about the adults who witness this?
Neither the director nor the nurses nor the students show any sympathy for the victims. On the contrary, they are excited about the scientific process and its success. Next, the students are informed about sleep teaching, the so-called hypnopedia. The director explains how scientists failed to use it for intellectual education, but that it can be used for moral education. They witness parts of a lesson in elementary class consciousness. 8 beta babies are lying in bed while a voice repeats over and over again how great it is to be a beta.
And the alphas? They are even cleverer than betas, aren't they? And all the lower castes are more stupid.
Additionally, they're taught which colour is connected with which class. At the end of this chapter, the director triumphs about the fact that the children's and the later adults' minds consist of the suggestions of the sleep teaching. So all their later judgments and decisions will be made on the knowledge given during this state.
So why do people not question this?
They don't really have a chance, because they were conditioned themselves. This is all they know.
What do you think about it when you read it?
Like you, I found that rather shocking, especially when they hurt the babies. But it's perhaps even more shocking to think about the fact that somebody already programs your brain when you can't even think yet.
Yes, I agree. But I remember also some satirical elements, don't you? For example, when the director makes the sign of the T for Henry Ford instead of the cross for Jesus Christ.
True. Wasn't Model T the first car constructed on a conveyor belt by Henry Ford?
Exactly. Just like the embryos.
Chapter 3.
Chapter 3 is a composition of different scenes, which are combined like a montage. In the beginning, the director leads the students into the garden of the center. Here, they watch the children play. The director explains that the children play with lots of manufactured toys so that they get used to consuming goods. They're not supposed to develop their own imagination.
Oh, that's terrible.
Indeed, there is a reference to that.
A second pastime for children is erotic play. Sexuality is nothing private or connected with deep feelings, but a common way to have fun. One boy who behaves differently and doesn't want to join the erotic play with a girl is sent to a psychologist. For the students, all this is perfectly normal, and they are surprised to hear that sexuality was seen very differently in the past. The narrator informs us,
"A look of astonished incredulity appeared on the faces of his listeners. Poor little kids, not allowed to amuse themselves. They couldn't believe it."
Just as they laugh about ancient ideas of not having sex until you are grown up, a new character is introduced. Mustafa Mond has one of the highest positions in Brave New World. His fortship, as he is addressed, is one of the 10 world controllers, namely the resident controller for Western Europe.
His fordship instead of our term lordship, that is another reference to Henry Ford, isn't it?
Quite so. And the students are honored by his appearance and listen closely while he tells them about differences between the past and the present and why it was necessary to create the society of Brave New World. He visualizes the past with images of families who lived in crowded, dirty places, and who experienced wild emotions. They believed in ancient religions, such as Christianity, and suffered from poverty and aging. All these descriptions make the students shudder. Then Mon goes on with a description of the 9 Years' War, after which people became convinced that stability must be the first aim of all societies. First, this aim was pursued by force.
I think the rulers tried to abolish and to forbid religion, culture, and historical interest.
Indeed. But this didn't work, as some people showed resistance. So the new idea was to develop a society in which all these things didn't play a role anymore. A society based on consumption, free sexuality, and drugs. This is the society of Brave New World in which, according to the controller's description, nobody experiences any frustration. And therefore nobody is tempted to change anything. Instead, stability ensures general happiness.
But as the reader, you already become suspicious, don't you? I mean, we know, for example, that family life has also got many advantages and beautiful aspects, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And the way this chapter is structured supports our suspicion.
What do you mean?
For the reader, Mustafa Mon's speech is interrupted by conversations taking place elsewhere. On the one hand, these conversation parts illustrate his points, but on the other hand, they also show that not everyone is as perfectly happy and not everything is as perfectly stable as Mon claims. One conversation is taking place in the girls' dressing room.
I remember. Here, two friends, Lenina and Fanny, are discussing their social lives.
You're right. Fanny reminds Lenina not to go out with the same man, namely Henry Foster, too often, as long-term relationships endanger the stability of Brave New World. She repeats one of the state's slogans that everybody belongs to everybody else. Lenina defends herself by expressing an interest in Bernard Marx from the Psychology Bureau. Yet Fanny considers him strange, since he is too small for an alpha, and spends a lot of time alone. She warns Lenina.
They say someone made a mistake when he was still in the bottle. Thought he was a gamma and put alcohol into his blood surrogate. That's why he's so stunned.
Meanwhile, the reader witnesses a second conversation and gets to know that Bernard is indeed different. He strongly dislikes the way Henry Foster and another colleague talk about sex. While all these conversations are taking place, the baby's production line is rolling on.
Ah, good summary. When I read the chapter, I found it very confusing with all these bits and pieces of different conversations.
Yes, so did I. I had to read it twice.
But to come to another point, what I found funny about the students' reactions was the reversal of our moral ideas. To be shocked that someone is not having sex with everybody else is rather amusing, isn't it?
Yes, quite so. To consider a car producer like Henry Ford to be a savior is also really strange. Yet the mass production of humans makes it also shocking.
Chapter 4.
I'll go on with Chapter 4 then. In the first part of this chapter, the story of Lenina Crown and Bernard Marx continues. Lenina meets Bernard in the lift of the center and tells him that she accepts his invitation to go to a savage reservation for a week in July. Whereas the other persons in the lift seem surprised that pretty Lenina is interested in Bernard, Bernard himself just feels embarrassed that Lenina is publicly asking whether he wants to have her. When they leave the lift, Lenina dates Henry Foster. Like many others, they take a helicopter across London to the countryside to play obstacle golf. In the second part, Bernard sees his friend Helmholtz Watson.
Helmholtz Watson? Isn't he an emotional engineer in the propaganda house?
Yes. Watson is extremely good-looking and talented. Yet, since he has received more oxygen as an embryo than an alpha minus should have, he is also different from the others. Therefore, he is dissatisfied, too. The two friends fly to Bernard's home. Here, Helmholtz tries to explain why he is not happy with the propaganda texts he writes. He wonders whether or how he could be able to write about something more meaningful. Yet he lacks ideas. He explains this with the words.
Words can be like x-rays if you use them properly. They'll go through anything. You read and you're pierced. That's one of the things I try to teach my students, how to write piercingly. But what on earth's the good of being pierced by an article about a community sing or the latest improvement in scent organs?
What about Bernard?
Bernard doesn't really understand what his friend is talking about. He suddenly fears that somebody is listening to their conversation. But this isn't the case. He then indulges in complaining about his own awful situation. Helmholtz pities him, but at the same time feels embarrassed.
I thought Helmholtz is definitely the most likable character in this chapter.
Definitely. He is intelligent and seems to long for something like a meaning of life. And that makes him similar to us.
But Bernard criticizes the system, too.
Yes, but he just complains because he thinks that he is not accepted as a real alpha.
Chapter 5.
Okay, Chapter 5 then. In the first part, the Lenina-Henry story is continued. The two fly back from their game of obstacle golf. On their way, they pass a crematorium. Here, people are not only burnt after their death, but the remaining phosphorus is used as fertilizer.
Ugh, that's disrespectful.
Surprisingly, neither of the two seems to be frightened by death. Instead, they comfort themselves with the sentences they have been conditioned with, such as, "Everybody is happy now," or "One has to be proud of being socially useful." After landing at Henry's apartment, he and Lenina eat in the dining hall, take soma, and then amuse themselves with music and dancing. At the end of the day, they have sex.
They obviously need to entertain themselves every minute.
That is my impression, too.
How does it go on, then?
In part two of the chapter, Bernard also tries to amuse himself. He attends a solidarity service. Some elements of this service seem to resemble a church service. The service is led by a president who makes the sign of a T instead of the cross, and people sing hymns. Yet they do not worship a god, but our Ford, and take the drug soma. The final aim is to achieve a state of ecstasy in which they feel to belong to what they call the greater being, and celebrate a huge sexual orgy. Bernard, however, does not feel any ecstasy. Once again, he is left out and just pretends to feel what everybody else apparently feels.
Wow, that's really strange.
That's what I first thought, too. But it also made me think about our customs and rituals. Getting drunk on a Saturday night isn't really the most sophisticated way of spending your time, is it? And how many people really seriously think about the problem of death anymore?
And what about the solidarity service?
Well, Karl Marx, the philosopher, said that religion is the opium of the people. And here it's really taken literally.
Ah, that makes sense.